The Irish Times Business Podcast in association with Irish Life.
8 of the top 10 Irish companies choose to do business with us. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life.
Hello and welcome to Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock, a podcast from the Irish Times. This week I was joined in studio by Gavin O'Reilly, former chief executive of Independent News and Media, son of Sir Anthony O'Reilly, who is now living in Los Angeles with a range of business interests. So, Gavin O'Reilly, welcome to Inside Business. You're looking tanned and healthy. What has you back in Ireland?
Well, I always love to come back to Ireland as much as I can, but on this occasion, it's Public Relations Institute of Ireland, which is having a big conference tomorrow, and surprisingly, they've asked me to speak.
Well, it's not that surprising, really, because you are chairman of Red Flag Consulting, which is in the communications business itself, and has been making a bit of a splash over the past couple of years.
Yeah, we've certainly been making a splash. I mean, it's not even 5 years, and the business is doubling every year. And
I should say, founded by Carl Brophy, obviously, who worked for you as the communications chief in Independent News and Media, and the two of you go back a long way.
I think that was the theory, that he worked for me, but I think I worked for him because, as I was talking to somebody yesterday, reminded of it, that Carl was a very young, impertinent 28-year-old wannabe editor down in South Africa, and he came to me with a proposition to launch a newspaper for the emerging South Africa, populist paper. And I suppose he just kept persisting. And I said, yes. And I think it was one of the great, great publishing success stories of all time. I mean, within a year and a half, he achieved over 1 million readers, beating our other two papers in the Cape Town market. So quite an achievement. So later on, when you look, was it February 2013, when Carl came to me and said he had this idea about sort of very direct, frank PR and communications company. I thought, what the hell? It's going to be a hell of a lot of fun with Carl. And if anyone's going to make a success of it, make some waves, it's Carl. And indeed, that's what's happened.
And it's Dublin-based, but it very much has a presence overseas now.
Dublin is obviously where the business originates. It's because many of the executives are from Dublin, but the vast majority of our business is conducted outside the state, across America, across all of Europe, and now increasing into Asia as well.
Yeah, and the reason you're speaking to the PRI is to talk about a coffee campaign that you were involved in, Red Flag, that is, and that won you some awards in New York recently.
Yeah, won us two awards at the PR News Elite Agency Awards, which was, real tribute to Carl and the team. I mean, they did a spectacular job. And, they took a much-loved commodity, coffee, which people don't know because I think Red Flag did such a great job, was under threat by various World Health Organizations. Apparently, coffee was not good for you. And I think largely because of the efforts of Red Flag, I think now everyone would agree that coffee is almost a superfood.
Right. Okay. Well, the jury might be out on that one. But anyway, just tell us a little bit about Red Flag. How big is it now? What kind of clients do you represent?
So there's probably now about 38 professionals in, I've got to think about this, 7 offices. Two of those in the United States, 6 offices, sorry. 2 of those in the United States. Our clients are, fast-moving consumer good companies, sort of FTSE 100 size companies as well. Not all of them. Well, as you probably know from recent court cases, we don't like to name our clients too often.
In a moment.
So, all I'll say is they're big, reputable FTSE 100 even one Dow component company.
Right. And as chairman, how involved are you? How much time does it take up?
So it's taking an increasing amount of time. And I suppose that just really reflects, the way the business is evolving. As I said, it's doubling in size every single year. So what was a non-executive role for me has sort of morphed into an executive role. And I think the business, I joke that, the business is now of a scale that can afford my expenses, not that they're that great. So I'm now, it's virtually a full-time job now.
Right. Now, Red Flag has been in the news over the last few years because there's been a long-running case. I think it dates back to 2014 involving Dennis O'Brien. a former adversary of yours, perhaps it might be a good way to put it, when you were chief executive of I&M, and he was a large shareholder in independent news and media, and Carl Brophy would have worked for I&M at that time as well. And he has taken a rather interesting legal case against Red Flag in Ireland, which came to court again last week. And his application to get discovery of certain documents in relation to that case was rejected by the court. Just explain the backdrop to that for us.
Well, first of all, just to correct the timeline, it was 2015, almost 2 years to this week. I think it was that we first received legal notification, where Dennis O'Brien, the plaintiff, was seeking what's called an Anton Pillen order. So basically a civilian search and seize against Red Flag for information that he felt that we had and that he wanted. Obviously, I'm constrained somewhat by what I can say,
sure.
Although, there's quite a lot been written about this.
Well, it centers around a USB stick, which he was sent anonymously.
Anonymous USB that subsequently seems to have done a tour of Europe. But I think the overall point is, 2 years on, the plaintiff has gone to court and not once, not twice, but three times, the learned judges have ruled. Now, as the court process is here, as it is in most countries, allows for appeals, and yet to be seen whether the plaintiff will attempt to get this before the Supreme Court.
And this centers around a dossier which he says was compiled by Red Flag on behalf of an unnamed client, which was potentially or could be very damaging to him.
Well, that's what he alleges, yes.
Mm. Mm. So what's the Red Flag position?
Well, the Red Flag position is that in the normal course of our business, we pull together research and information on lots of issues, lots of people, and it's our absolute right to do so on behalf of our clients. And in respect of the plaintiff wishing to or demanding that he had some God-given right to know who our clients is, quite simply, he doesn't. And client confidentiality is paramount to us. And I think this is... He's prosecuted this. I mean, you need to ask him why and on what basis. And all I can say is, the law has been pretty prescriptive in terms of its ruling so far.
Okay. It does still potentially have some legs to run, though, doesn't it?
As I said, if the plaintiff can, formulate some sort of argument why it needs to go before the learned judges in the Supreme Court. And I think he has 3 weeks to do that after the last week's ruling has been perfected, which I believe will be this week. So, we'll know before Christmas what Mr. Ryan wants to do.
Yeah. Now, you left I&M in, I think it was April 2012, just over, five and a half years ago, thereabouts?
5.5 years ago, yeah.
And that followed along and sort of protracted... standoff, if you like, between Dennis O'Brien as a major shareholder in I&M and your family. Your father had been chief executive of I&M and had effectively...
Created the modern day independent news and media as it was. Yeah.
And you succeeded him as chief executive. Do you think this court case is a residue of that dispute?
I really don't know. Dennis O'Brien has said that he has some right to know the provenance of information, and if it's from his number one enemy. I'm not quite sure if I'm that person or if it's somebody else. I'm not quite sure why he would continue to prosecute in relation to I&M. I mean, certainly when I was chief executive of I&M, his representatives on the board would go out of their way to confirm to me and the other directors that Dennis O'Brien did not have any influence whatsoever in I&M. Whether this is a holdover, I don't know. But I mean, it does seem to me that. In relation to independent news and media, whether he controls it or whether he doesn't control it, he does appear to have achieved what that which he wanted, which was me out of the picture. But that's 5.5 years ago. So I'm not quite sure why it would linger on.
Yeah. What was the reason, do you think, for the standoff between Dennis O'Brien and your family? What was behind it? I mean, he spent an awful lot of money. He lost an awful lot of money. By his own admission in public, he's lost probably over 500 million euro on building that stake in I&M. And ultimately, he succeeded. Your father left the business as CEO. You were ultimately resigned. You can give us your take on that perhaps a little later. But what was the genesis of the row, if you like, between the two sides?
I really don't know. I mean, and of course, I do want to say, Kieran, I don't want to spend the entire podcast talking about Dennis, but I genuinely don't know. I mean, I knew Dennis when he was running around Dublin in the early 90s, and he cut a swathe in town. I mean, he was, had a real sense of the possible and was doing great, great, great things. And he had great, great success. But as to why, after all that success and good fortune, there was, attempt to be, I don't know. I mean, there are people that say, does it have something to do with the newspaper coverage? I don't know whether it does or it doesn't. All I know is that my involvement in matters editorial was extremely limited. Beyond, setting budgets and appointing senior editorial people, I did not write what was in the paper every single day. And I don't think there's any doubting that some of the coverage about Dennis, not just in the Irish Independent, the Sunday Independent, the Evening Herald, but in the Irish Times and the Examiner, all the rest, may not have always been favorable in the context of the Moriarty Tribunal and its findings. And but I suppose in a sort of a bizarre way, Independent was the only public, and by that I mean publicly traded company, where Dennis might be able to focus his attention. He couldn't do it to the Irish Times, obviously owned by a trust. The Examiner was, a small family paper down in Cork, and the state broadcaster is just that, the state broadcaster. So he didn't have many options, to focus his, train his guns. He opted, I suppose, for Independent. But as for the personal animus, I don't know, because as far as I know, I don't believe that my father ever met Dennis until this much storied meeting that took place in 2009, February 2009. I don't think they had met prior to that.
Right. What dealings did you have with Dennis during that whole standoff?
During the, it depends which standoff we're talking about. Dennis came on as a shareholder in 2006. The alignment, which was written about at the time, which is when my father stood down, and when I became CEO, that was 3 years later in 2009. There would not have been much interaction. I think there was a lot of public.
Sparring.
Yeah, that's a very good way to say. And on both sides, there was. Both sides were sort of throwing bricks at one another. And in hindsight, if you could do it all over again, might you play it differently? Possibly. But I think after 2009, obviously we had his quote unquote representatives on the board, it's clear that they spoke for him. There were in the early days when we were trying to deal with a very, very complex financial restructuring in the summer of 2009. Yes, I did have some direct interaction, as was appropriate, because the our lenders at the time felt it was terribly important that both major shareholders, being my father and Dennis O'Brien, were across the plans for the restructuring. So I did have some dialogue. But for reasons that are only clear to Dennis and maybe all his advisors, they then, sought a different path than the one that we were going down. Ultimately, at that stage, we resolved the financial restructuring. But you'll recall in the fall of 2009, I can't remember how many EGMs had to be called over various issues. So that, I think, was probably the last time I had any dealings with Dennis directly.
Right, of course. And then Leslie Buckley, who's a very close business associate of Dennis O'Brien's over many years, was he was removed from the board, wasn't he? I mean, it was pretty pretty unceremonious, and I think he was he wasn't happy with that, as you would imagine.
Yeah,
and he was a representative with Dennis O'Brien.
He was a representative, but of course now he's, you know, it's rather curious the way things evolve. He's now, of course, chairman of INM today. I mean, look, there's, I suppose, a degree of schadenfreude in my case. I mean, for years, you know, after 2006, 2007, 2008, I had to listen to nauseating accusations about lack of independence and, you know, cronies on the board and all that sort of stuff in relation to independent newspaper. And all I'd say is, you know, if I look at INM today, you know, I think it's probably a case of the cat calling the kettle black.
Yeah. So what do you make of the latest events at INM where we had Robert Pitt and Leslie Buckley in a very public fallout over, you know, potential deal for News Talk, which is owned by Dennis O'Brien, a radio station. And then we had the fact that he made the protected disclosure, and now Robert Pitt has just left the business to pursue other business interests, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't have any insights. As you can imagine, people don't call me up from Independent and share the news with me like they might have in the past. You know, I'm sort of minded of Oscar Wilde's, you know, comment, you know, to lose one CEO is, you know, regrettable, but to lose two is possibly reckless. I mean, you know, there seem to be a number of CEOs in the company over the last couple of years. It does seem as though, and this is just, you know, from 5,000 miles away, the governance of the company is a little bit upside down. I think it's clearly proven, I think the company itself, admits that it is not technically compliant with the independence. And the issues around News Talk and, you know, protective disclosures and all the rest, I mean, I'd never seen anything like that. I'm surprised. I never met Mr. Pitt, but I'm surprised he lasted for as long as he did. And it must have been extremely difficult for him. And it must be difficult for the board, too, to figure out how the hell they can navigate in a way that is positive to the shareholders that are not Dennis O'Brien and not Dermot Desmond, but the other 50% of the shareholders.
With the benefit of hindsight and without wanting to rerun the whole saga of sort of pre-2012, did Dennis O'Brien, was there some merit in what he said about the way the company was being run at the time in that, you know, maybe there was a bit of cronyism, maybe the board was stuffed with some cronies, or maybe there was a bit of nepotism. After all, you were in the business, you were a senior executive in the business that your father effectively, you know, ran and was a major shareholder.
I'm never going to be able to dispel the charges of nepotism. I'll have that all my life. You know, look, if I felt I wasn't, that I didn't do a good job and that I wasn't capable, I wouldn't have been in it. I mean, I don't, you know, have enough pride in myself. I think, you know, empirically you look at, you know, the operating metrics of our business. You look at, you know, our peer group. And I'm not saying just in Ireland, but I'm saying worldwide. You know, I think we can be pretty proud of our achievements at Independent at that time. The challenges that we had at Independent weren't about the board. Weren't about, you know, Dennis's perception of cronyism or his perception of corporate governance, which I think now looks somewhat hollow, those comments. It was that, you know, we had, you know, a fairly aggressively leveraged company that had always historically been fairly leveraged.
Heavily indebted. Yeah,
heavily indebted.
I think 426.8 million at the time, around the time you stood down.
Right, but I mean, you know, 3 years earlier when I took over as CEO, it was about 750 million. So, I mean, we were going in the right trajectory. And look, debt is not evil. I mean, Dennis O'Brien will tell you debt's not evil. God knows he has enough of it at Digicel. So, I mean, if you want to drive shareholder value, you got to have the right balance of, you know, debt to equity. And, you know, for the majority of the time we did, our challenge in 2009 is our dramas were, I think, you know, aggravated somewhat by the state of the Irish banking system itself. So banks that would have stood with you suddenly found themselves not being in a position to be able to stand with them for their own problems. And, you know, without boring all your listeners, but if you go back to 2009, what triggered, apart from the, you know, the impact of the GFC, and the huge falls in advertising. I mean, over a two-year period, our advertising fell by 50% in Ireland. So that was a fairly substantial drop. But I mean, our biggest issue is we had a 10-year, 200 million euro bond that just happened to mature in May 2009. And we had a supportive bank group by and large, but some of the banks, which will remain nameless, basically decided that we would not be able to refinance the euro bond, and that we would effectively have to equitize it. So that sort of triggers all sorts of dramas in any public company, and that's what happened. And it was at that time when, you know, you're having falling revenues, falling profits, but we were still hugely profitable. I mean, let's not lose sight of that. And you have, you know, shareholders who are aggravating. It was sort of a rather messy cocktail. But I don't, you know, I've also said, I mean, on record, although I haven't talked much about this in the past, but the limited comments I've made on it, I think we could have achieved a different outcome. I think we could have a different company, I&M today. I mean, let's be honest, I&M is but a shadow of itself. It has no debt. It has cash. It doesn't seem to know what it wants to do with the cash. Perhaps it should return it to its shareholders if it can't find anything to do with it. But we could have, I think, back in 2009, had a different outcome, you know, had the shareholders truly been in alignment, and had we had a banking, had our banks in the whole agreed a different path than they choose to go by. So, like in my time, there was never any prospect of us forcing our banks to take a write down. I mean, that subsequently happened in I&M. Obviously, I wasn't chief executive, and obviously that impacted AIB, which was owned by the taxpayer. I mean, that was remarkable. I mean, the purest capitalists out there would say brilliant piece of financial reengineering, but I mean, ultimately it was the Irish taxpayer that lost out there. So, you know, the way we were facing the financial restructuring back in 2009 was, you know, we were trying to keep everybody whole, and we also wanted to conduct our affairs around the board table, which is where it's most appropriate that it gets conducted, and not across the airwaves. Unfortunately, at that stage, if I can call them the other side, they opted to go via the airwaves.
Yeah. Do you still have shares in I&M yourself personally?
No.
Right. Gone. Out of it. Okay. And do you think, looking back, that again, with the benefit of hindsight, that it might have been doing you a favour by having to resign in April 2012, because the newspaper industry has been a pretty difficult, it's in a pretty difficult spot, even now, 5 years on. And I include the Irish Times in that. Circulations continue to fall, print advertising continues to fall, and the expected jump in digital revenues hasn't quite emerged, and nobody really has figured out how to fully monetize digital, even the big players in the US.
Well, Google has.
Well, Google has, but I mean, come on, yeah, Google's a disruptor.
What you're saying is
traditional newspaper operators. Yeah,
I mean, look, it's the market was always going to sort of consolidate, and it was shrinking even my time. And we were sort of managing decline and trying to put the best financial results around it. I mean, you know, circulation was not growing every single year, even when I was at Independent. But, you know, I always looked at it as being, you know, there was going to be some consolidation in the marketplace. The market leader, if they stuck to their knitting, you know, was always going to outperform the rest of the market. I mean, that subsequently has not happened here in Ireland, but I'm just saying that would have been my posture back in 2012. You know, I certainly would have been more, I think it's more challenging now. The rates of decline in circulation are obviously a lot more aggressive than they have been heretofore. But I think something interesting is happening in the world of journalism, though, and largely led by, you know, the rather unusual president that they have in the United States right now, because the advent of fake news, as it were, I think is really creating a need and, importantly, a desire for quality journalism. And, you know, use that phrase that I remember using it back in, you know, 99, 2000, content is king. You know, that was in the context of AOL buying Time Warner. And of course, every media property in the world, valuation shot up, and you know, And so everybody was, me included, was spouting out the wisdom that content is king. But that was content is king on the basis of suddenly the valuation of your business is worth 5, 10, 15 times more than it was before. But the value proposition now is, you know, it's more operational, if I can say it like that, in the sense that people are, you know, they are dipping back more and more into newspaper. I mean, you look at stats for the New York Times, for the Washington Post. You know, I'm not saying they are, you know, reversing the declines that they have seen, but they're certainly slowing the trend down as more and more people are coming back desperate for good quality journalism. And as I said, content is king. So I think good quality journalism will always be relevant. So, you know, in terms of would I like to still be in this business? Look, I grew up in this business. I love this business. I mean, for 6 years, I was president of the World Association of Newspapers. I know all the publishers around the world. I know the journeys they've had, good and bad. There's some fabulous people, fabulous companies, fabulous titles. Yeah, it's a very, very interesting space. And, you know, in respect of digital, you know, it may be in the less obvious places. I mean, if you look at the digital successes we had at Independent, you know, they weren't typically based off our editorial products. They were based, you know, whether it was our bingo sites or our, you know, iTouch, you know, various other different value creators that we had. So do I miss it? Sure, I miss it. And there were a lot of great people that I worked with that I miss. Some I still stay in touch with, I'm happy to say. But I think I'm happier now doing what I'm doing in Los Angeles.
And what newspapers do you read, can I ask?
So I read, I don't read the Irish Independent anymore.
Really?
I look at the Irish Times now and again, except you keep wanting to get money from me, which I suppose makes a mockery of what I just said. I look at the LA Times, which is just because I live there. I like the Wall Street Journal, and then I sort of dip in. You know, there's a magazine called The Week and The Economist. So that's sort of my reading every week. But am I as religious on my daily read of the newspaper as I used to be? No, obviously, you know, I had to be before. I don't have to be now in that context. And obviously, being in the communications business like Red Flag, I'm somewhat spoiled because the team puts together some pretty
clippings and stuff
awesome, like clippings and perspectives on what's going on in the world.
Yeah, sure. Okay, we're going to take a short break now. When we return, I'll be talking to Gavin O'Reilly about life growing up in the O'Reilly household and about his life now in Los Angeles. Back in a few moments.
Only 29% of us know how much we need to live on in retirement. Irish Life is changing that with Empower, a new approach to company pensions that helps change the way your employees think about their future. For more, go to irishlifeempower.ie or talk to your pension consultant. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life. Irish Life Assurance PLC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. All information sourced for Irish Life, June 2015.
Now, welcome back. This is Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock. Let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free on iTunes, and it's also available on our website, irishtimes.com/podcast. I'm joined in studio by Gavin O'Reilly, the former chief executive of Independent News and Media and the son of Sir Anthony O'Reilly. I should ask you about that. What was it like growing up as the son of Sir Anthony O'Reilly? Because he was a very famous rugby player, both for Ireland and with the Lions. He had a very storied career and then a hugely successful businessman. I think the first non-family chief executive of the Heinz Group in America, and then obviously Independent News and Media, Waterford Crystal and so on, which everybody knows about in the Irish context.
So I think as my 10-year-old son would say, it was awesome. He's obviously living in America, so he's picked up the local Lexington. Mm. But
what's your first memory?
My first memory is in our house in Pittsburgh, him arriving back and he was being driven, and the guy that driver that brought in the bags, Mike, I always remember Mike, would carry in all his briefcases. And he had those brown leather, like the airline pilot's bags, and he had one for each company that he was involved with. So he had about 10 of these bags. So you'd see the bags, and there'd be a great expectation that a father would follow immediately afterwards. But he, of course, was still sitting in the car on the phone to somebody. That's my first memory. All his briefcases.
Right. Okay. And was there ever a present for little Gavin in any of these briefcases?
I don't think he viewed that was his role. I think he relied on my mother to provide the gifts. So if she went away with them, yes, she always brought back six little gifts for the kids.
Right. This is your mother, Susan, who was Australian.
Was Australian, yeah.
And six children in the family. And you were, of course, one of triplets.
Yeah, six children. So it makes my mother even more remarkable that she had six children in 4 years, because obviously the triplets came last. And, you know, that was in the early 60s in Dublin, and she was from, you know, sunny Australia, and she moved the other side of the world to Dublin. And, you know, my father was still playing rugby and was trying to build his career at Bourbonia first, and then obviously the sugar company. So my poor mother was, you know, tending to six kids in Mount Marion in Dublin.
Okay. So when did you move to America?
So we moved to America... 1971.
By boat, I believe.
Yeah, I know where you're going with this. yes, because I always, yes, we did go by boat, like the thousands of other Irish before us, but it was, I must confess, the Queen Elizabeth
II. QE2.
The QE2. I do remember that trip. That was a fairly epic trip, yeah.
How long did that take? That must have been a few days, I guess.
5 days.
5 days.
5 days. And you know what's interesting? Well, it's interesting to me. It might not be interesting to your listeners. I can remember coming into New York Harbor. I can't remember passing the Statue of Liberty, but I was on deck. But they were building the World Trade Centers, the two towers, and there were cranes on them. And, of course, you know, coming in on a boat and seeing the end of Manhattan. And 30 years later, almost to the day, I was in New York on September 11th. Tragically, to watch those towers fall down. So, but I so can remember, that was my first vision of America, was the Twin Towers.
Wow. And that was the whole family, everybody packed up on the QE2.
Whole family and my grandparents, my father's mother and his father, and two dogs.
Two dogs.
Yeah, I think that was the whole crew.
Right, okay. And how long in America?
How long did we stay? Well, I mean, lived on and off in America all my life, but I stayed there until we stayed about 10 years. So we did all our primary schooling in Ireland. And then for reasons that are only clear to my parents, they decided that we should go off back to Europe to go to school. And we used to come to Ireland every summer for 3 months every summer, which was spectacular. But there was never any question of school. That was, you know, Ireland was a place where you had loads of fun eating Tato and Cadbury Dairy Milk and all the rest, not suddenly going to school. But we suddenly announced that we were going to school. So my brother Tony and I ended up going to a school in England called Harrow, made famous because that's where Winston Churchill went. Let's just say we didn't last, we didn't fit in as well as we'd like. And then we both came to Ireland a year later and went to Clongowes.
Okay. Well, your father had a very famous rugby career. I mean, did you play rugby yourself?
I think because he had a very famous rugby career, I did not. I was a better smoker and drinker than I was a rugby player. But my two brothers, though, they were both on the Senior Cup team at Clongowes.
Tony Jr. and Cameron.
Yeah.
So what was it like, I mean, having a father who was obviously a very successful chief executive and businessman and investor, I guess, later on, what was it like? I mean, was there pressure on you to sort of follow in his footsteps? Did you feel any pressure?
No, I don't think pressure. I mean, I think, look, looking back, you think, wow, how privileged you were. I mean, you'd be, whether it was Castle Martin, which was our house down in Kildare, or in America, you'd suddenly come down for dinner. And we were always included in any events if there were people coming to stay. And, you know, you'd be, you know, sitting there with George Bush or the elder, I should say, or Henry Kissinger. Those are in the early early years. And then, you know, obviously as I went through school and then I got into business myself, you know, the opportunity to meet business leaders on both sides of the Atlantic. That was a great opportunity. My father is a very inclusive person, and he likes to bring people together. And, you know, he likes to share, I suppose, the experiences and introduce. And he was particularly proud to, and this isn't me trying to wrap it in green, but I think you should know from his efforts in the Ireland Fund to his own investment philosophy in Ireland. I mean, he could not have been more proud to be Irish and eager to showcase Ireland to Americans. So, I mean, he was sort of almost like a one-man idea. He brought in so many people.
Yeah. Was he tough on you, though, as kids? And was the pressure to succeed in school and no. And then in business?
No. I mean, he was hugely busy. So, I don't think he'd mind me saying, I think his children became more interesting when we could, you know, string together a coherent sentence and maybe contribute to the conversation at a dinner table. Snivelly little kids running around making noise, I'm sure it didn't fill him with glee. And he traveled so much.
Yeah.
I remember in the 70s when we were living in Pittsburgh, I'd say every weekend he was on the EI 104 from New York back to Dublin. Because in those days it was Fitzwilton, it was the early days of Independent, it was, you know, and so many of the other investments that he had in Ireland. Whilst at the same time, you know, running a Fortune 500 company like the Heinz Company.
Yeah. I mean, you ultimately ended up in Independent News and Media. When did you make that decision that that's what you wanted to do with your career?
So in 91, 92, so I had a kind of I didn't have the most obvious academic route. So when I left Clongowes, I went to London to work in a ad agency that was supposed to last 2 months. I was supposed to be pouring coffee, and I was the fabled client's son. The only problem is I was there for 2 weeks, and the client, Heinz, fired the agency. So even though I wasn't getting paid and all my job was to do was to pour coffee, my position was looking somewhat precarious. But I remember saying to the managing director at the time, I said, look, let me stay on, let me help on new business. Anyhow. 2.5 years later, I'm still there, and I kept deferring my university. And then I went to university in Washington at Georgetown University, and I was there for a year. And then a friend of mine who I knew from London said, what the hell are you doing at university? You know, why don't you come to Hong Kong and be a stockbroker? And that made no sense whatsoever. So, of course, I jumped at the chance and did that for a couple of years, then went back to Georgetown and finished it. So I finished all of that in beginning of 92, and I was not sure exactly what I wanted to do. Did I want to get back into financial services because that would have been the most recent thing I'd done? Did I want to get back into advertising? And I had my own network. And I went to Australia and New Zealand traveling with my father on that trip. And I spent, I suppose, 6 weeks on that. I mean, starting in Ireland and eventually getting back to Ireland was about 6 weeks. And, you know, during that time, you know, I was hearing a lot about Independent and you know, obviously this is before email and we were still dealing with, you know, photosensitive faxes and things like that. But, you know, I suppose my father would just share stuff with me about it and it looked really interesting. And what I was particularly interested in actually was the cable business. That we had with Liberty, but now it's Liberty Media.
Princess Holdings.
Princess Holdings, yeah. As it was, yeah. And then it became Chorus, and now I'm not quite sure. Virgin Media. And I wanted to do that, and I remember my father joking with me and saying, oh, that's far too valuable for you to be. If you want to get involved in Independent, you've got to earn your spurs. So there was a little, and little being the opportune word, a division called the Independent Directory. Mm-hmm.
Kind of like a Golden Pages, if you like.
You're very kind to say that.
Slimmed down
by virtue that we didn't have as many ads as the Golden Pages. But yeah, it was a competitor, pretender to the Golden Pages. I suppose for a generation, it was very important because it had maps and it had coupons, which were... two features that the Golden Pages did not have. Anyhow, I ran that, and you know, we had some good fortune there, and that sort of got me into Independent. And look, I said before, you know, I probably managed to get on the express elevator. No question about that. But I don't think there people that have worked with me. I don't think there would be too many people that would argue about my, they may argue about my capabilities or my judgment, but they certainly won't argue about my commitment for the job, my work ethic. So I was very fortunate to get the opportunities at Independent that I did. It played its toll, in relation to my personal life. I mean, I worked incredible hours. I traveled, like 300 days a year. I suppose that was the judgment that I made, that it was important enough that I did it. And I enjoyed that aspect of the job and the opportunities and, forging new markets as we did in India, Indonesia, helping South Africa develop new products in South Africa. So it was a great period, but it wasn't, I wasn't sort of sitting around twiddling my thumbs. I don't think there's any executive that you'll find. I don't even think the O'Brien representative directors would say that I was twiddling around. I mean, they may say other things that may not be entirely true, but I don't think they would say that I was, just a journeyman. I certainly wasn't.
Yeah. The Independent newspaper in London, of course, was one of the stable of titles that you owned during your time in charge at I&M. And I understand there's a curious story involving Harvey Weinstein, who's made the headlines of late for all the wrong reasons. And an article that was being written by one of the female journalists at The Independent.
Yeah, but it's not a story that, when you mentioned female journalists, it's not a story I think that is going to go the way that people think it's going to go. So, simple enough story. 2008, sort of after, so it must have been May or June 2008, and I was in, of all places, Mexico City, meeting Carlos Slim, who was a shareholder of Independent News and Media. And,
the Mexican telecoms billionaire.
Billionaire, yeah.
And a rival of Dennis O'Brien's in the Caribbean, I believe.
Yeah, I believe so.
Or Central America.
More Central America. I was in Mexico City, and suddenly my phone starts ringing. And, this is nearly 10 years ago. We don't have smartphones, or the phones might have been smart, but they're not as smart as they are now. So it didn't necessarily say who it was, unknown number. I get it, and I won't name all the personalities, but over the next because I don't need. let's say one was Philip Green, one was Richard Desmond, another one was a very high-profile PR guy in London, and one was Harvey Weinstein. The Independent in London was doing an article about Harvey Weinstein. I didn't know anything about this, but all these people were calling. And they were asking, not asking, they were yelling down the phone, telling me to kill this story. Hard to kill a story, one, if you're not involved with it, and two, you didn't even know it was being run. Eventually, because all these people were calling, and I'm sitting there thinking, oh, my God, is this, what is going on? I have to get some perspective here. I call Simon Kellner, who rightly tells me to F off.
It's none of my was the editor.
He was the editor of the time, and he rightly told me to F off, and told me to tell these people that that we're calling, if they call back, tell them to F off as well. So I didn't need to, because the next call I got was from Harvey Weinstein. And I've never met Harvey Weinstein, never talked to him before. But he started yelling down the phone at me, saying that he had done an interview with a journalist who I didn't even know who the journalist was, and all sorts of expletives, and that, he was going to sue me, he was going to sue the paper, unless the story gets canceled. Anyway, I did what many brave executives Independent have done when it comes to matters editorial. We did nothing. And I went off and did my whatever I was doing in Mexico City. And eventually I flew back to London, and 2 days later there was a bouquet of white flowers, I can't remember, are they lilies or roses, from Harvey Weinstein to thank me for the article, because apparently the article had turned out to be a really positive article about Harvey Weinstein, who I think was going through some financial difficulties and he obviously felt that I had intervened in some positive way, which of course I hadn't.
Yeah, okay. Well, he's going through some difficulties of an altogether different colour right now.
Absolutely.
Let's just talk about post-INM. You went and you were leading the talent agency, which was a company that was representing a lot of entertainers. Tell us a little bit about that. And later it was sold.
Yeah. So it was a music agency called the Agency Group. It was the largest live music agency in the world. So we represented about 2,500 artists, ranging from Guns N' Roses to Dolly Parton to Macklemore to, I mean, it was a wonderful collection of artists. And it was started in England by a guy called Neil Warnock, who had, you know, his much storied, wonderful guy who's worked with NEMS, which was the Beatles management company. So he's been, you know, part of the rock and roll scene in the UK. And he built this little agency out of Islington in London and took it to America. And, you know, he's still very active even to this day. He must be, what, I'm getting older, so it's not that old. He must be 71 or 72 now. And he's still booking bands and booking shows. And I think he was making a judgment. I got to know him through somebody else. And I think, you know, I was obviously trying to figure out what my next gig was. I think he was sort of saying, you know, I find it more interesting doing what I'm best at rather than being a CEO. And the business was of a scale and complexity that, the timing just worked. So I got involved in the business. It was great business. A lot of fun, a lot of really interesting people in it. About half our business was in the United States. But I think what was happening in the industry or is happening in the industry, the big, big talent agencies which are doing film and TV and books and stuff like that, they're obviously trying to get into music in a big way. And several of them are private equity backed. And, you know, you kind of look at the economics of them, you're wondering how are they able to pay the prices that they are for the agencies that they've bought. So I looked at it and I said, well, you know, we need to, because we were just more or less exclusively music, we either need to miraculously get into film and TV and take on guys who've been doing this for 90, 100 years, or we need to exit stage left. So that's really why I moved to America back in late 2014, which was, and I think I knew the answer before I got there. Could I put together essentially set up live TV and movie agency.
Or sell.
And I met all sorts of bizarre people, and LA has its fair share, who promised the sun, moon, and stars. And I made a judgment pretty fast that the best route was to sell. And I genuinely thought that the process would take a couple of years. You know, schmoozing and trying to find the right buyer. And a company called United Talent came along. They're the third largest. They didn't really have a music division. But, you know, they do, you know, the Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt and, you know, all those, Gwyneth Paltrow, all those sort of A-celebs. And then they wanted a music division. So they were able to buy us lock, stock, and barrel. So it was a great deal for our shareholders, the shareholders that I was representing. And then I think, you know, having, you know, got my residency back in America, my kids are at school, the weather certainly is a tad better in Los Angeles than it is perhaps in Dublin. You know, my wife and I decided, you know, let's take a chance in this great country of America. So that's...
Can I just ask you about that, actually? Because I think I'm right in saying you've Irish and Australian citizenship. You're obviously living in the US at the minute. You went to college there, you know, and you, as you said yourself, you've traveled quite a bit. And in terms of your business interests, you've been in many, many countries. You've had business units in many countries, etc. Do you see yourself as Irish, or are you in some sort of citizenship limbo, as it were? Do you see yourself as a bit of a global citizen?
Well, I think to call myself a global citizen sounds a bit pompous. Do I see myself as Irish? Yeah, I do. But I think I have to persuade people that I'm Irish because they listen to my accent and say, oh, really? Look at this. I look at RT.ie and the Irish Times quite a lot. You know, look, I can't take away the fact that Ireland has been such a hugely, hugely important part of my life. I have a daughter that lives here, is at UCD. My other daughter has moved to LA. You know, so I still have very, very obvious connections here. I've got, you know, many, many friends that I stay in touch with. I think if you meet my American friends, you know, they would because maybe their ear doesn't allow them to make a judgment of whether you've got an Irish accent. They all think I have an Irish accent, which is hilarious. And they, I think, would, you know, they will call me up if they're going to Ireland. They want advice because I'm their resident expert on Ireland as far as they're concerned. So, yeah, I'm quite proud to be Irish and I certainly fly the flag as high as I can. I'm involved with the Ireland Funds, which is, you know, I think a truly great charity that has truly stood the test of time. It's 40 years now. I think it's raised over $500 million for
causes north and south.
North and south, yeah. On both sides of the, well, the divide that hopefully is not as much of a divide as it used to be, and I think largely because of the work of the Ireland.
And are you involved, still involved in Drumoland?
I am.
The hotel?
I am. I am, in fact, I'm here next week for a board meeting.
Okay. What about your dad? How is he?
He's great. He had some back surgery. I mean, here's my advice to anybody listening. If somebody says, oh, get your discs fused, don't. There's always going to be a doctor out there that says they can do wonders. So he's gone through the wars a little bit on, he's had three bouts of back surgery. But I spoke to him at the weekend. He's 6'2", and the importance of saying he's 6'2" is, I said, how are you? He said, well, I'm able to stretch now, and he's back to his 6'2". So, yeah, he lives most of the time in France, and obviously he's gone through
bankruptcy.
Some pretty extraordinary times. But I think happily he's sort of moved on to the next phase of his life.
It must have been tough for him, though, you know, a pretty public process. And
well, it didn't need to be, but it, you know, certain bank chose to go that route. And
that bank being AIB?
I believe so, yeah.
And Castle Martin, the former family home, which you mentioned earlier, that was put up for sale.
Now owned by
John Malone.
So, I mean, a great that there's somebody who's going to, you know, keep it in up to scratch, that's for sure.
Yeah. And when you look back, has his legacy been tainted somewhat by all of that? Or what do you think his legacy will be?
No, I don't think so. You know, it's amazing. People come up to me all the time and say, you know, where's your father? And obviously my father's been sort of a bit camera shy as of late. I mean, apart from the back problems that he has, happily that are behind him, you know, he's living in France. He doesn't come to Ireland that much. And some people feel that he's sort of hiding away. Not hiding away, it's just the interests that he had here in Ireland he no longer has from a business perspective. So when he comes back, he's coming back for friends and he's doing so in a private capacity. But people are saying, oh, wish you could see them. And, you know, I think they think that he's sort of skulking and hiding away. And they're the ones that are saying, look, here's a guy that is, you know, and look, for half of the people listening to this podcast, you know, they'll remember Tony O'Reilly of old. I mean, who, you know, was the guy that sort of helped put Ireland on the map, during the late 50s, 60s, 70s. We'll remember his sports career. And he's still got two world records that are still standing, as his grandson, my son, reminds me about, because he's very proud of that. And, you know, you go to, well, I suppose the easy way if I talk about my 10-year-old son, who's now this little American kid, and he goes to the supermarket with me. And so he's very excited when he walks down one of the aisles and he can see the ketchup, which is what Granddad made. Now, I don't think Granddad was ever actually in the kitchen. And then we go down to the dairy area and Kerrygold, which is truly one of the great success stories. And I don't know how much it gets written about, but Ornua and what they're doing with Kerrygold in America is amazing now, because I think it's like the fourth largest selling butter now in America. So he can go
selling premium butter in Germany.
Yeah, well, yeah. And it's going that way in America. So I mean, they're doing a fabulous job of whatever they're doing there. But my son is able to walk by and say, "Oh, and there is." So he's looking at all these different sort of windows on
his
grandfather.
Is there a copy of the Irish Independent for sale?
There isn't a copy of the Irish Independent, although I think my son does remember that I worked there, so he knew that. And I think he does, he knows there's a bit of Waterford Wedgwood, or Waterford Glass and Wedgwood around the place. But I mean, these are sort of, you know, there's enough there in any one of those for somebody's career. And for him to have done all of that in a 50-year career and create the Ireland Fund, I think is, you know, his legacy is assured.
So what's next for Gavin O'Reilly?
What's next? Well, I'm going to be busily working on Red Flag. I mean, that's just going so phenomenally well, and it's just with a fabulous group of people that I really, really respect. A lot of former colleagues from Independent there as well. We call it Continuity I&M in many ways internally. So it's that's going to keep me really busy. That and you know, I've got some other interests in VR and some new technology stuff in Los Angeles, just because, you know, you hear about the opportunities. And so I'm chairman of a VR company there that, you know, I think does some pretty impressive stuff.
This is WeMersive?
Yeah.
Right, okay. And you're also involved as a director of Bayard Capital?
Yeah.
Right, okay. And any interests, any business interests in Ireland or anything you'd like to do here? Do you see yourself settling back here eventually?
No, I don't think, you know, I think the epicenter of my world now is, you know, from a home base is the United States. Unless Mr. Trump decides to kick me out, which case... So I'm not giving up my Irish passport, if that's what you mean.
Right, okay. Gavin O'Reilly, thank you for joining us. That's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Declan Conlon, who produced the show, and JJ Vernon, a sound engineer. Don't forget you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Ciarán Hancock. Until next time, take care.